The following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, and I'm riding solo this week. Dan went off to the family reunion in southeast Texas, I believe. I can't remember exactly where, but he doesn't have a good signal. He assures me he would otherwise have gotten up early to call in, so I'll take him at his word. And as normal, let's get through the rest of our disclaimer. There is going to be information talked about today that may or may not fit your facts and circumstances. Please don't go execute on that information, but check with your advisors and make sure that they agree that those strategies or that content or that tax issue does or does not apply to your specific facts and circumstances and or investment opportunities. I think I'm going to talk about one today in Dan's absence. But in any event, we're going to revisit some topics we talk about often that are near and dear to our heart, the 401 trust, along with Roth conversions, and I guess what made me think about this again. Well, number one, you know, it's a situation where a lot of our listeners that tune in do not have the benefit of prior shows, and this is going to be even more the case here in 2 to 3 weeks. We're going to be expanding our show out across America, 6 new stations from Atlanta over to LA and San Francisco, and in between Phoenix, Seattle, San Antonio, etc. So we're going to, I don't want to say we're starting over, but we're definitely going to have to consider talking about some of the basic concepts behind how we suggest you consider these real estate private partnership syndications. It all revolves around that investment choice. We think that's absolutely the place to be. I'm assuming those of you that watch the financial news noticed this week where Fed Chairman Jerome Powell indicated that March is going to have a 50 basis point rate hike, twice what it was a month ago, and they're going to be more aggressive, he says. And the problem is inflation is stubborn, at least this time around, and it's not going down. And, you know, when you look at the various indexes, and I can't remember, I don't really obsess on which ones are going up or which ones are going down. All I know is when the chairman of the Fed talks about even more aggressive rate hikes, you know, it's not a good thing. So the right indexes apparently are going up. And so, you know, where do you want your money? I mean, if your money's sitting in cash, you know, you've moved your money out of your 401, out of the market within your 401, and you've got it sitting in cash, you're losing ground. Unless you think of not losing money or not letting the market whip your balance, beat your balance up, you know, you're not worried about, you know, the price of stocks and bonds and the index funds dropping. But cash is no solution, really. I mean, in terms of not losing ground, I mean, it's kind of like quicksand, I guess, or it has been as of late. And I guess I keep hearing, you know, that the smart money is going into gold and silver. And I would tell you that's even got ups and downs. It's kind of like the stock market, maybe just not as extreme. But, you know, we still like real estate. Real estate has kind of a silent ability to crunch out profits just because the NOI, the rents that people pay every month, you know, the inflation, you know, real estate is a good asset to own in periods of inflation. Your rents go up. Yes, your expenses go up as well, although typically the rental income hikes are something you control to a certain extent and give you the ability to tough out some of the things that we see during these inflationary periods. In any event, what I started to say was the reason I wanted to go into details again on 401 trust and collaterally Roth conversions. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal, let's see, the 25th. So when was that? 2 days ago, right? Or 3 days ago. I'm sorry. I'm trying to remember which time zone I'm in. In any event, the thing that caught my eye is burned out, more Americans are turning to part-time jobs. The number of people working part-time rose by 1.2 million in December and January. Most were people who chose it. That was kind of the critical point that caught my eye. 25 hours, quote, 25 hours is the new 35, end quote. And, you know, I talk about having a part-time gig. As part of the 401 trust strategy, one needs to have some self-employment income. And we've talked before many times about how a side gig is the best way to qualify. You can work at a large company, say a Microsoft or a Exxon or whoever, Google, and you can effectively take control, if you're in Texas at least, you're married filing joint, well, you're married, you can be filing however you want, and or you turn 59 and a half, or you work for a company that puts a in-service distribution option into your 401, where maybe you're 55 and you can take that money. The in-service distribution option is something that we put in every 401 trust document that we have clients adopt. You could be 35 and decide to take money out. That's your call. You're going to pay penalty if you are below the 59 and a half mark. But the point is, you can get to it. I had a prospect that sends me information ongoing about the, I'm sure some of you are probably totally oblivious to the fact that United put folks that would not take the jab, as we call it, on unpaid indefinite leave and restricted or prevented many of them, I guess through their administrator. It's not United, it's one of the big brokerage houses, which is common for 401 plans. They restricted people's access to their money in terms of hardship distributions, loans that they might have already taken out, etc. And I, you know, my comments back to this person that was telling me this, I said, well, there you have another reason, if you didn't already have enough, to want to be able to control your money, to invest it in something that you think has a higher likelihood of creating wealth for you than stocks, bonds, mutual funds, index funds, etc., maybe real estate, maybe multifamily private partnership syndications, which is where I've seen a lot of money made by my clients over the last 20 plus years. And the good thing is, in the great state of Texas, we have the ability, the way our community property laws are structured, to where you can get access to your money and you can effectively partition or convey those assets over to your spouse. And you can do that through another IRA or self-directed 401 trust rollover, or your spouse can take the money out. And if they're under 59 and a half, they're going to pay tax, but they pay no penalty. So we've got a unique set of rules that I'm not sure it's only Texas. We've got, I believe it's 9 community property states, and then I believe Alaska will allow you to use community property rules if both spouses agree. But that said, it's not just the community property rules alone. There's got to be, I guess, sufficient regulations that allow our folks, Texas, to repartition those assets. Some of the states, like California, as an example, is community property, but they are not able to use these rules unless there's a dispute, meaning that, you know, there's likely a pending divorce or a separation or something's getting ready to happen. And then there's other states that will allow a tentative repartition, I guess would be a good word, but you can't actually execute the partition until or if until a divorce might occur. So just because you live in California, I believe Nevada, Washington State, New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, I believe Louisiana, and Wisconsin, maybe, and I may have that wrong. I think Louisiana's on that list. Anyway, just because you live in a community property state doesn't mean you can do what we can here in Texas. And so bottom line is, when this gentleman was telling me what was going on with United, and of course they've got litigation that's moving forward finally, because again, it seems somewhat, you know, back in the good old days, I don't know, maybe three, four years ago, it would have been thought to be unconstitutional to make someone take a vaccine or a shot that they didn't want to take. It's still hard to believe that that was foisted on many, many people. I think it's probably about half of our population in America took the vaccine. And of course, as we're learning, the vaccine was pretty inept for the reasons that were advanced as to why we should take it, i.e. we want to not transmit. We don't want to have as bad a case of COVID were we to get it, which I'm not sure how you would ever know. I've known people that later tested for COVID and found out they'd gotten it. They had antibodies in their body, and it's like, well, I guess they didn't have a bad case. How many other people have it that didn't have a bad case? And the bottom line is, I know a lot of people that took vaccinations. In fact, I think you could throw the whole White House into this statement that, you know, most of the people at the top of the totem pole there got it at least twice, and they had access to all the jabs and boosters and took them, for all we can tell. And here where I'm at in Southeast Asia, the health minister of this country had 6 vaccines and boosters, and he got COVID twice, just like our Dr. Fauci did. And so, anyway, bottom line is, I think there's going to be a price to pay by some of these employers that jumped on the let's you know, put people on leave if they won't take vaccines. And you know, I think the more cases that make it through court, you're going to see that, hey, I know the pharmas disclose that you could get heart attacks, strokes, clots, everything that's coming now, and they disclosed all that. But there's got to be a point where there's negligence when they had information showing how many people were dying. And again, I'm not against vaccines. I've taken every vaccine that ever came out in my 62 years except this one, and I would have taken it had it been trialed for 10 years and, you know, the changes had been made to keep people from dying. But anyway, that's another issue. What I'm talking about is controlling your 401 at the big company, taking control of it, rather, so that you can invest it in alternative assets that you think have a much higher chance of getting you some additional retirement wealth, especially if you're behind. And if you want to see what just $10,000 of self-employment, side gig type income can turn into over 20 to 25 years, depending on when you start with real estate private partnerships, just, you know, give us a chance to show you. And if you want to see that, you can go to our website at baplanner.com. And if you will fill out at the top right, you'll see some forms or a link to some forms. If you'll fill those out and submit them, you know, you can just click submit there at the bottom of each form and I'll get them. Dan and I will be happy to have a chat with you, which you can set up by going to the link right next to the form link, which is for scheduling a call. And we'll show you what that $10,000 or whatever you want to pick. You can pick whatever number you'd like, and we'll show you how much impact that can make in addition to what you already have. You know, if you have some IRA or some 401 money, that can also be utilized in the 401 trust. But the key is that you have some self-employment income, because at base, a 401 trust, which is also known as a solo K, that's the marketing term, the term in the code section. I'm sorry, the term in the Internal Revenue Code, section 514 C9, refers to any qualified trust pursuant to section 401. And so that's where we derive the name 401 trust. But in any event, it is an interesting confluence of factors that makes this strategy really appropriate for Texas residents. Not only do we have some of the most real estate private partnership syndications between, you know, Dallas, Austin, Houston, San Antonio, et cetera, the major cities, we also have a significant number of syndicators based in these cities or based elsewhere, but they're working properties that are in Texas. And then we have the ability to tap our retirement funds. And, you know, when you think about it, most people's wealth is wrapped up in their 401 or IRA. And most people, in fact, I'm willing to bet that most people within the sound of my voice did not know that they could access their retirement money before they quit working. And again, if you're listening to me in California, well, sorry. That's not going to work for you, but for Texas residents, it's a wonderful strategy to take advantage of. But anyway, I want to talk a little bit more about, because this could be just the nudge that someone needs to realize, hey, it might not be your idea of using your extra hours for something that you would otherwise maybe not want to do, but when you realize how many other people have realized the benefits, then maybe you start to think a little differently. And it's interesting. Well, I'll tell you the quote that for me was the takeaway on the whole article. But anyway, the number of Americans working part-time rose by 1.2 million in December and January. Most of that increase, and this is the statement that I was referring to, most of that increase, 857,000 workers, were driven by people who worked part-time by choice. By choice. Not because they were unable to find full-time work or their hours were cut. The number of people working part-time voluntarily, 22 million in January, is now almost six times the 4.1 million who were working part-time in January. I'm sorry, part-time, but would prefer. Let me say that again. The total number of people working part-time voluntarily, 22.1 million in January, for the month of January, is now almost six times the 4.1 million who are working part-time but would prefer to have full-time hours. That is the highest ratio in 20 years. In the first months of the pandemic, when millions of Americans were laid off and couldn't find full-time jobs or saw their hours cut, those numbers were about even. In the 20 years before the COVID pandemic, the ratio typically stayed between 3 to 1 or 5 to 1. In total, 16.3% of the 160 million Americans who were employed in January worked part-time hours, which the Labor Department defines as anything less than 30 hours or 35 hours in a week. I know 30 hours is the metric that I believe the ERISA Act, which is what governs 401s, uses. The increase in part-time workers reflects changes in the U.S. economy and the historically tight labor market. According to economists, employers, and workers, as the pandemic led to burnout among some workers and drove many to reconsider their careers, some have downshifted to part-time roles. And, you know, there's other reasons here. Some folks had caregiving responsibilities thrust on them from COVID or other health issues or just aging in general. There were school commitments, and some of that is still in play for millions of American workers. But, you know, part-time work, an economist at Penn State says that part-time work for non-economic reasons is expanding faster than one would think, and it seems to have leveled up to a higher level. And this economist says he doesn't see it trending back. And I don't know, but all I can tell you is this could be a win-win if you know, someone that has been thinking about, even if it's an additional job or, you know, 1099 scenario, independent contractor, over and above a main job, that still gives you the self-employment income that we need, as long as you're getting a 1099-R or you start your own business, whether it's a, you know, eBay store or, you know, you're doing some consulting. Maybe you've got a knowledge base that's in demand outside of your main job. And so, you know, again, the ability to adopt a 401 trust and contribute funds to that 401 that can be invested in alternative assets such as real estate private placements becomes, you know, very desirable given the tax code, given the ability to build significant retirement wealth, et cetera. And let's see here. I think I've talked enough about that. And so when we come back from the break, I want to talk about the other side to this equation, is that now once you have self-employment income, you have a 401 trust, you may or may not be ready to do the rollover from your big employer plan, but I'm going to give you a reason that you should do it, and you should do it as soon as you can, given what is inevitably coming down the pike in terms of tax rates, deficit budgets, etc., etc. So let's go ahead and take that break. We'll be back in a few minutes with more of the Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Bobby McGee, I'm just longing to be free. Take me where I want to be. Big dreams and big dreams. And there are many just like me. With big dreams and faded dreams.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195.
713-581-0195. Or you can send an email to nathan@npross.com. nathan@npross.com.
The Syndication Math Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, focuses exclusively on helping investors understand the current options for investing. The syndication arena has changed. You can now take advantage of direct online investing options without expensive upfront membership fees. Nathan Ross, CPA, discusses these options and more, including the math involved with partnership selection, reporting, and performance. On the Syndication Math Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, Sundays at 7 a.m. right here on KSEV.
Okay, welcome back to the second half of the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, my sidekick, Mr. Dan Dubose, CPA, is taking the day off. He's at a family reunion, which I guess that could be worse than working, right? In some cases, I know I've heard some stories, not about Dan's family, of course, but from other families. But in any event, we were talking earlier about the huge increase in side gig work, part-time work, that has happened just here as of late. And we also talked about how the Fed is not taking their foot off the gas with additional rate hikes. And I guess the other thing, there's a article, let's see, where was it this week? Yahoo Finance. Well, actually, it's a video. This is another economist that's saying it will be a, quote, or it will be, quote, a long and winding road to the Fed's 2% target. And without going back through that video, I believe that the projection in this economist's case was two to three years, which I don't think is unreasonable, given what, again, Chairman Powell announced this week about being aggressive. You know, unfortunately, they haven't had, the economy hasn't experienced near the number of layoffs that would cool down spending. And then you've also got the government throwing even more deficit spending on the fire. That's not going to help. And so you've still got a confluence of factors that are driving, you know, continuing to stoke inflation. And without that, I'm telling you, inflation has just an incredible impact on everything else that the government has afflicting it. When you look at we've talked about this just in the recent past, maybe it was last week or a week before, the interest on the debt will be up to basically $1 trillion a year here by the end of the year. And you look at everything that goes cattywampus when you start spending more on the interest on the debt than on the military. Think about that. The expenditure for debt service will exceed what we spend for military. And, you know, it's going to hasten the day that tax rates go up. It's not, as I've said before, it's not a question of the math. I mean, of the political affiliation. It's the math. And the math shows that we're going to run out of discretionary budget expenditure by the year 2029 to 2030, maybe sooner, depending on how high the interest rates go, because, you know, the T-bills that we've sold in the past, the Treasury bills that are on relatively short-term lifespans, those are coming due. We're having to pay more on the new ones to go out that's funding the government. And I got one for you. How about when we start putting more pressure on the Chinese, which were already threatening to do, denying them access to U.S. markets. I'm just wondering, when's China going to raise their hand and say, you know, when you do that, we're gonna restrict our access to buy your T-bills? Think about that. Who's going to buy the huge amount of treasury bills that China has now? If I'm not mistaken, it's close to $2 to $3 million they hold in our debt. It's a very tangled web we weave when we start playing with sanctions and other things. In fact, another article I saw this week is that Putin's economy is basically back to where it was before there were any sanctions. And I think that was a point I made when the U.S. first announced sanctions, is that you watch, it's going to hurt us worse than it hurts them. And their economy, for all intent and purposes, has returned to pre-Ukraine invasion performance. And, you know, I'm not sure what else. I mean, we still haven't done what we should have done in terms of sanctions even now. And if we just literally turned off the old spigot by not, you know, but I guess not buying any or allowing people, other countries to buy it, that might have had an impact. But now with the price of oil having gone back up and looks like it's going to continue, I believe is the current prognosis, I don't know that there's really been much effect at all. And I think the bigger issue is if we can somehow choke off ammunition, that's where the shortage is, from what I read, with regard to the Russian military. They don't have the ammo quantities they need, or, you know, so it's unlikely they can finish the war at all, is what some of the military geniuses are saying. In any event, so back to the concept of rising tax rates and whether you think that's going to happen in the next 5 or 6 years like Dan and I do, I think you understand why it has to happen. And the problem is, for those of us that might be headed towards retirement, if we end up getting to retirement at about the time that you start taking your required minimum distributions, let's assume that you don't do what I'm getting ready to suggest to you, which is consider getting into the tax-free arena with Roth conversions. The latest version of the, the Inflation Reduction Act, simultaneously the Secure Act 2 passed at about the same time, if not the same time. I think it was the same time. The required minimum distributions are no longer mandatory for a Roth 401, just like they haven't been for the Roth IRA. And yes, there's differences in the rules, and there's still big differences that would suggest you know, would be wise to undertake whatever self-employment activity you can so that you can legitimately have a solo K or 401 trust. And in that case, then you won't have to take a specific amount of money out. You would probably take out some amount in your retirement years just because you need that money to live. But when you're taking money out of a Roth, you aren't typically going to get taxed on your Social Security, because the money that would be coming out of an IRA or a 401 on a pre-tax basis would normally push your income up high enough to where you would pay tax on up to 85% of your total Social Security income. Whereas with the Roth, those dollars that are coming out of the Roth do not go into the calculation to determine whether you made too much money, you exceeded the provisional tax brackets, is what we call those. And unless you've got a pension or you've got significant other income from interest, dividends, etc., you probably won't get over the provisional bracket. And it's a combination of how much you make and are getting paid with Social Security and you know, net of your standard deduction. So that provisional bracket is typically high enough where you won't be subjecting your Social Security to tax if you don't have a monthly pension or some other form of gains. Maybe you sell stocks and have gains. That could cause this to have your Social Security being taxed. But we've got clients that make typically somewhere in excess, when you just look at the gross number, maybe $150,000 a year, where a big chunk of that is distributions out of their Roth and they're paying no tax. That's where you want to be in retirement. And there's other tools we use to get there. The Index Universal Life tool that we've talked about on occasion is another. When you take loans from your Index Universal Life cash value, it doesn't even get reported on a 1099-R. There is no report in that case if it's structured correctly. And so there's multiple ways, multiple buckets that we want to work with to get you into that zero tax. It's not really a bracket, but it's tax calculation where you come down to zero. How do you convert to Roth, and why or when should you do it? And, you know, I had another prospect call me this week and said, well, you know, I take it back. Well, you know, it was a prospect. They said, I've got X number of dollars that I've already rolled in to a solo K and investing in these real estate private partnership syndications, but I've still got another big chunk of money still in my Fidelity account. And I keep hearing you talk about Roth. And so I understand I can definitely convert to Roth on the solo K partnership investments. I don't have to sell the investments to do so. And I do need evaluation of those assets so that I know how much tax I need to pay. And I said, well, yeah, that's correct. That's part of what we do for our clients, is come up with a value that reflects the private company discounts that are available that allow you to execute execute a payment to the IRS. I mean, I'm kind of shortcutting it, but basically we complete a 1099-R showing that amount. It's treated as a distribution effectively for tax purposes without the penalty, and you pay tax at that lower amount net of the discounts. And he said, why wouldn't I just go ahead and convert the money sitting at Fidelity? And I said, well, as I just explained, you've got private company discounts once the money's been rolled out to your solo K / 401 trust. How do you think the value is going to work if you look at converting funds with Fidelity? When you call Fidelity up and say, you know, you want to do a Roth conversion, what kind of valuation will I have to work with? They're going to tell you they're going to look at the market at closing on whatever day you decide to pull the trigger. Maybe you wait till, you know, some of your stocks drop down for however long they're, I mean, who knows, right? But, you know, a good time to convert market-based assets is when they drop, and it's painful otherwise. And, you know, the other problem is that you may convert and those assets may never come back, okay? So, you know, it's hard to say, whereas with real estate, I don't think I've had a client in 20-plus years of focusing on this segment of tax planning and structuring and preparation that's ever lost their investment. I've had clients that didn't make as much, but I don't think, if I've had a client that's lost money, it wasn't anywhere near the amount that I lost the last time I bought a stock, which was Enron. And nobody in the real estate sector that I've worked with has even come close. And so again, you know, sometimes people complain, well, you know, I thought I was getting a 2.8 equity multiple and it only ended up coming out at 1.9 because something happened, you know, in the course of the real estate transaction over time. And all I can tell you is, okay, yes, things like that happen, unforeseen in most cases. Who would have thought, for instance, right now, that the cost of insurance would be killing more transactions that are trying to raise money and get started than the interest rates. Insurance has shot up around the country, and it's just absolutely painful if you're trying to get into particularly Texas, Florida. Those are two areas that I've watched and know firsthand about the difficulty. But the interest rates are one thing, and you might be able to find a transaction that you can assume. Just saw a transaction recently that was assuming a 3%, or maybe it was a sub 3% loan that they were going to have 3 years left on. Well, that's a pretty significant opportunity. And that said, don't think the seller didn't price that into the deal, but still, it gives you a little bit longer runway, if you will, to exit that transaction. But anyway, so just to summarize what we said about the 401, first, you have to have some self-employment income, which, by the way, we can help you find that. There's, several websites that show hundreds of potential side gigs that you can execute and generate revenues. So you've got to have the self-employment income. You may or may not have your money tied up in a 401k at the office, but if you do and you live in Texas, you're married, then we can absolutely help you access those funds. And so the idea is you get control of your money, you invest in these private partnership syndications, where for every one of these investments, the SEC mandates that the risk factors are disclosed to you on why your investment may not generate the income or the outcome that you hope. Well, those are the same reasons that discounts to cost value apply, i.e. lack of marketability. You can't transact that property or that interest in that partnership that you invest in readily. You may never be able to sell it. I mean, that's unlikely, but that's what the verbiage that the SEC mandates. You may not be able to rent the units, may not be able to refinance them when you think, you may not be able to sell them when you think. And then there's a whole litany, another 20 to 25, that are mandatory to be disclosed in every private placement memorandum, at least the ones that are done with non-accredited investors. And, you know, we do have a distinction there between accredited and non-accredited. And for those of you that may not have listened to prior shows, you may not be aware, but if you've got under $1 million in net worth, then you are non-accredited and you'll be restricted to how transactions come across your radar. You cannot respond to a general solicitation. You have to have a previous relationship with the syndicator. And actually, it's not because you're not accredited or you're non-accredited. It's because that the transaction is offered under the crowdfunding statute section 506B. So even if you were accredited, you've still got to have a previous or prior relationship, quote unquote, with the syndicator. But in any event, so once you get your money invested in these private partnerships, then we look at doing Roth conversions. And generally, we want to try to optimize and do only as much as you feel willing to pay the tax on. We normally try to keep people in the 22 to maybe 32% bracket on the high side, unless as far as they look out down the road, they're still in that top tax bracket. Well, that top tax bracket, if you believe the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, it's going to have to double if we're going to truly fix the deficit. So, 37 versus 75 or 80. I've seen, I believe the CBO projected 88% back in 2009 for the top bracket on the study that they did concerning the deficit. So even if you're in the top bracket now, unless you plan on expiring, soon, you probably should be thinking, well, you should be thinking about a Roth conversion. And speaking of that, we started to talk a little bit last week, but we didn't really get into it much about the length of time that our life expectancies have morphed into. You know, it's good news, bad news. The good news is that many Americans live a lot longer than they expect. The bad news is that this often leads to financial regret. That means you run out of money before you run out of living. That's what this Wall Street Journal article calls financial regret. I like that term. Sometimes it's too late. And that's why we're talking about real estate private partnership syndications and 401 trusts. These are tools that allow us to make more faster, thus extending the amount of money we have to match our extended life expectancies. And, of course, there's other tools, long-term healthcare coverages, et cetera, that we can often pair up with cash value insurance, like the Index Universal Life, the ability for you to get a rider on a life insurance policy instead of buying a chronic illness or a long-term health care specific policy, which are very expensive. But in any event, there needs to be a distinction. I see this general topic talked about a lot, and there doesn't seem to be a distinction between life expectancy and longevity. There is a difference. Life expectancy refers to the average number of years someone will live from a given age, whereas longevity refers to how long he or she might live if everything goes well. It's typically expressed as the probability of living beyond a certain age. That's the one you should be worried about, because and that's the one most people are just oblivious to, is the so-called longevity risk, the probability of living a very long time and the financial complications that presents. And so, it's not just enough to make your retirement wealth in general. You've got to time it right. I see a lot of people that start investing in these real estate private partnerships, and they exit one, go into the next one, maybe exit that one or two or three, go into more, and they're really not putting a pencil to when and how much they've got to start tapping those funds. And the chance that you might live a very long time in retirement and run out of money is something that I'm amazed at times how little people have focused on that. They just seem to think, well, I'm being very successful with my real estate, that's probably all I need to do, with not really thinking about the calculations on cash flow and when you can get your money out. You can't just call your partner, your lead partner up and say, hey, I need 50 grand to pay next quarter's living expenses. That's not how these partnerships work. You get your money out when the partnership either makes money by operational cash flow, which is income over expenses on a quarter, a month, a year, whatever that period may be in specific cases, or you refinance the property and you're able to take out a slug of cash, or you sell it, or maybe you refinance it again. A lot of ways to get your investment exited out of the partnership. But the bottom line and the problem is that those may not be on a particular frequency that you can count on paying your bills with. So there's always the opportunity, or the need rather, to project ahead, go ahead and take some cash off the table as you're able, consider the tax impact, consider unknown expenses, things like that. And, I would also tell you that if you look at the statistics, there's a large number among the ages of, 65 to 69 year olds, 18% receive over 90% of their income from Social Security. And by the age of 80, that number rises to 33%. And so, there's a lot of people out there that don't have the retirement wealth necessary to sustain, say, a 90 to 95-year-old longevity risk. In any event, let's see. We've only got a couple minutes left, but I wanted to point something out. I think we talked about this deal. Let's see here. I think we talked about this transaction. It's an Austin transaction a couple, 3 weeks ago, and I was just kind of looking back over some transactions, trying to remember a couple concepts, and let's see, what was it that stood out on this one? Well, they acquired this property at a 15% per foot discount to recent comparable trades. That's a big deal. But the cap rate that they were projecting at exit was advisable. It wasn't a long reach in terms of what that deal might do. And on an acquisition price of $90 million plus, the fact that they were buying it at such a cheap amount gives them quite a bit of excess on the cap rate. They've got a 4.7 exit cap just generally, but when you look at their debt structure, effectively to the investor, it ends up being more money because, again, they've got a significantly stabilized debt scenario where they won't have interest. I believe they've got, for the 3 years that they're projecting to hold this deal, they've got an interest rate cap at, I was trying to find the number here. It's a low amount. Like, I want to say it's between 2.5% and 3%. So theoretically, even though the exit cap may not look all that conservative, that's considering what a buyer is going to pay them. And when you look at what their payoff is on debt, it effectively allows a nice equity multiple, on the bottom line. But in any event, and then the debt, the secured financing involved allows for extensions up to a 5-year term, which, again, it gives you quite a bit of runway if what looks like may be happening with Fed policy is indeed the case. Well, I'd hope to spend a little bit more time digging in on that transaction. We may do that next week, and maybe next month. Depends on what happens here. But in any event, we're coming to the end of the show here for this week. We look forward to being back next week with Dan on board once again. And I've pigeonholed away a couple transactions that came in this past week that we'll get to next Sunday. But we hope you can tune in again, same time, same station, 7 a.m. Sunday on AM 700. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Be sure to tune in for another edition of Be a Planner Show here on AM 700 KSEV.